Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And I'm hearing things falling on tables. I'm not sure why I'm hearing that. And we're here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis. Steve is now back from his sojourn in the Caribbean, which I'm not jealous of at all. And he sucks.
I'll take it.
Okay. I'm not burning with envy. I'm not burning with envy.
Well, you know, I do want to say that this was the first time that Suzanne and I have gone away as a couple without kids since we started having kids. So yeah. It's been a while, considering that our oldest is going to be 22. So yeah. This was our 25th anniversary, and it was a long time coming. And we had an absolute blast. We had a great time.
Oh, I'm so happy to hear it. Really, I am. That's great. It was fun seeing. I was watching your progress on Facebook. You would post little bulletins about cool things that you did, and it was fun to sort of live that vicariously. My wife and I are looking forward. Our kids are, you know, our youngest is now 19, mm-hmm. And so we're looking forward to resuming our newlywed life. Which was rudely interrupted about 30 years ago. And so that'll be fun. Although we have, in fact, managed to get away one time. Because last October, Jan and I, through happy circumstances, we managed to work out a thing where we got to go to Scotland together. So that was pretty exciting. It was just the two of us wandering through, you know, the heather. And the Highlands and all of that. And that was, I must say, a real gift from God. So I affirm you in your okayness and in your going to your Caribbean paradise destination and all the fun you had. So congratulations. Another 25. Mazel tov.
Yes. Yes, yeah. Indeed.
Well, I thought today you've written a couple of pieces for Crocs on Hollywood and religion. That I thought might be worth a discussion.
I have. This is a topic that I have not surprisingly been thinking about for a while.
Have you then?
Hollywood and religion. But particularly the way that the way that people and religious identity and religious symbolism, imagery, iconography is used in contemporary Hollywood, is used in the mainstream movies in Hollywood today. I mean, we talk on this show about a lot of great films, including a lot of films with great religious themes. And we talk about movies like Of Gods and Men and Sophie Scholl, The Final Days. And a while ago, we talked about a Polish French production that's in art house theaters right now, The Innocents. And what all of these films that I just mentioned have in common is that they're not Hollywood mainstream films. And these are the films that people look at when we take a measure of the diversity of the film industry. We want to look at the movies like, say, the top 100 movies of any given year from the big studios in Hollywood. And people examine these films from all different perspectives. You know, how many of the important characters in these movies are women? How many of them are people of color? How many of them are LGBT? And all these questions that people ask. And then typically the finding is that, you know, most of the important characters in the biggest movies are white guys. Right. And those are all conversations that are worth having. But there's a conversation that I've been reading a lot of film writing over the years, and there's a conversation that people just aren't having, and that is, how are religious characters portrayed in mainstream films, and how are the tokens and symbols of religious identity portrayed? And the long story short, the two big takeaways are, we're bad guys a disproportionate amount of the time. And then secondly, they just don't portray us much at all. Religion is basically invisible in Hollywood for the most part.
Mm. Yeah. And I think you're, it's true. For me, a lot of times, you know, when you're looking at a film, a lot of times the question is, what do you mean by a religious character? Because you get, you know, there are characters that are tropes, and there are even tropes, you know, within. So the religious hypocrite, mm-hmm. for example, is a beloved in films. But the thing is that, you know, culture warriors will often say, well, this is an attack on the church. You know, it's Jesus who populates his parables, you know, with the Pharisee who, you know, stood next to the tax collector and
you know. Okay. Mark, I don't know if I'm the only one who's hearing this, but I'm hearing you kind of dropping out. So I hear what you're saying about yeah. how people of faith are portrayed. And I do want to emphasize, you know, I'm not the guy who's out there looking for people of faith to always be portrayed as the good guys and the heroes. I mean,
right.
You look at a movie like Spotlight, which certainly does not put the Catholic Church in a good light. It was one of my top right. five films of last year.
It was a great film.
So there's certainly a yeah. place for, you know, the people of faith are like everyone else. There are good ones and bad ones. But... Uh-huh. I notice that in the big blockbuster type films and in the mainstream Hollywood films, it's not surprising, for instance, when you go to the theaters right now and see a movie that's out there, which I do recommend, which I think is a pretty good film. It's one of the better films of the summer, The Legend of Tarzan. And in that film, Christoph Waltz plays a bad guy. We've talked about him before on this show, Captain Leon Rom. And he's not portrayed as a religious guy. We don't see him praying or Bible thumping or anything like that. But his weapon is a rosary. Yeah. And he talks about, he whips it around like Indiana Jones. He strangles people with it. Jane tries right. to attack him, and he totally shuts off her attack with this rosary. Uh-huh. And when he tells her that his priest gave it to him as a young boy at the age of 9, she has this kind of smirky line where she says, oh, you must have been very close to your priest. And yeah. you know, all the people in the theater chuckle over this. And
right.
And she's the heroine, so we're meant to laugh with her at right. creepy priests.
Right. Right. And so, yeah, that's all true, you know, that there is that tendency, and it's especially, of course, it's directed at the last acceptable prejudice, as Arthur Schlesinger Jr. called it, Catholics. Sometimes I think it would be great if somebody made like some sort of, you know, thriller murder mystery or something, because very typically when you watch a film like this, if there's a religious character, you know that this character is going to turn out in the end to have actually been the villain, because who would have ever expected
right.
a Catholic in a movie to be a villain, you know, and it's always the Catholic, you know, and I'd love to see, you know, some show where we're all set up for that. And then we discover that, you know, that the Catholic actually, he may have seemed to be a villain, but it turns out that the true villain was somebody that you aren't constantly directed to assume is going to be a villain.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because I got, when I posted these two pieces on Twitter about Hollywood's portrayal of religion, I got a tweet from a local critic who I know somewhat well. We see each other at screenings. Mm-hmm. Not a writer of faith, but he's always interested in what I have to say about faith-based films. Mm-hmm. And he mentioned that there is a film coming up called The Hollars, Hollars. And he said that it's a lovely film with a warm, positive portrayal of a youth pastor, not a Catholic.
Okay.
But what he said was, he said, while he was watching it, he kept waiting for the, but he's a bigot / hypocrite / pedophile.
Right.
Just, you know, for the shoe to drop, and it never came.
It never did.
And I said to him, you know, sometimes it's that shoe that doesn't drop. It's my favorite surprise watching a movie.
Right. Yeah. And that's the thing is it is possible, of course, to show a really deeply flawed religious character and yet at the same time still take their faith seriously. I think probably one of the finest portrayals of that I've ever seen is Robert Duvall's The Apostle.
Oh, yeah.
What a hell of a movie. Man, it's a great movie, and everybody should see it. And, when I watched it, I discovered Duvall wrote it. Mm-hmm. I don't remember if he directed it or not, but he said he directed it. He directed it as well.
Yes, he did.
And it was just pitch perfect in its portrayal of that particular subculture of American
Southern Pentecostal
Christianity. It was so perfect. I came away thinking he has to have spent time in that culture somehow or other.
He's from Texas, and that was his goal,
right,
to portray this culture in a way that you don't usually see.
Right. Magnificent piece of work. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. We're talking today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis. We're talking about Hollywood and religion. And we'll be back right after this.
You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.
Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis, who has now preached his third homily. Am I right? Have you done that?
Yeah. Yes, it's three. And
you've done
homilies 2 and 3 are both up at my blog at the National Catholic Register. I do that with some misgivings. I'm still a very new homilist, and I don't think of myself as, you know, offering any kind of model for anybody or anything that's particularly, you know, worthy of celebration. But I have found, and first of all, I've had people ask me to post them, so I've done it, you know, partly to honor those requests. I've also found that blogging, you have a different relationship with something that you blog versus something that you prepare to give in a one-time talk. And for a number of reasons, just the fact, and this was something that really came home to me blogging the second homily, just the fact that a blog post requires you to put a title to your piece forces you to clarify and focus your thought and say, what is the essence of what I'm really saying here? I've got to put in the title.
Yeah.
And that was something that I remembered as I was doing. I said, oh yeah, okay. I think one of our homiletics professors told us that. He said, when you're trying to write a homily, think about the title. Imagine that you're going to give it a title, because the title will force you to crystallize around an idea.
Okay. You know what? Here's what you do. I've got the perfect idea. So you do a homily and then give it the title something like, Jesus Meets a Canaanite Woman. What happens next will shock you.
Well, that's not the style that I use. You know,
Pharisees hate him, right? So
there probably are homilists out there. That kind of title would work really well.
So, yeah, I think people should start just using clickbait wherever they go, no matter what. So, mm-hmm. Well, anyway, so we were talking over the break. When we talk about a religious movie, part of the challenge, of course, is defining what that means. Typically, when people mean a religious movie, they mean something where Jesus or a saint or some biblical figure shows up and it's about them, or it's about some religious figure. So, you know, King of Kings is a religious movie, and Jesus of Nazareth is a religious movie, and The Passion of the Christ, religious movie. But then you get, and you might get, you know, like there was a biography done of Luther a couple of years ago. So that's a religious movie because Luther's a religious figure. But then you get to things like A Man for All Seasons. Is that a religious movie? I mean, it's about a saint, but it's not really, you know, it's not done like a religious movie. It's not.
It's a movie that's much beloved by religious people, but it's a film that is really about a character. It's about his psychology, and it's about his it's not about his beliefs as much as it is his relationship to his beliefs.
Right.
And what he can concede to his enemies and what he can't. And the fact that there's something that he can't. That was what really interested Robert Bolt about Thomas More, was that this guy, he was not a stiff-necked fundamentalist who wasn't going to compromise on anything. He was someone who attracted Bolt. He was sophisticated and funny and urbane and popular and successful, and someone who loved his family and his freedom and was, you know, had a healthy fear of suffering and death and bad things happening, and was more than willing to make a whole lot of compromises until he reached a line that he couldn't cross. And it was the fact that he couldn't cross that line, more than what the line was, that interested Bolt.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, when you, that's the thing, is when you start talking about a religious film or a religious story, it gets it can start getting very complicated, because you can argue, of course, that religious beliefs, and particularly Jewish and Christian beliefs, suffuse so much of our storytelling that it becomes difficult to ultimately to eradicate it, and you wouldn't want to.
Sure.
You can argue to a certain extent, you know, that The Day the Earth Stood Still is a religious film. The guy who wrote The Day the Earth Stood Still very consciously wrote it as a kind of a Christian allegory. Mm-hmm. So he, you know, when Klaatu comes to Earth, he takes the name of Mr. Carpenter.
Right.
That's not an accident, you know, and he dies and rises from the dead and all the rest of it. And he very much wanted to put into it that kind of Christian content.
Let me give you another example.
Okay.
Since you mentioned a carpenter, there is a film from 2002 called The Son. The French title is Le Fil. It's from the Dardenne brothers, Jean-Pierre and Luc Dardenne. And their protagonist is a carpenter. And it's called The Son because he has two different relationships. One with an off-screen son, a son who at some point in the film you learn something bad has happened to him. I don't want to give it away, because the way that the film is structured, it keeps its secrets and reveals them slowly. And then there's this young man, someone who has just, you know, he's been in trouble with the law. And our protagonist, who's played by Olivier Gourmet, kind of takes him under his wing, and he's kind of mentoring him in the trade of carpentry. And there's, you know, the son carrying wood on his back, and, you know, a lot of things that resonate with the Christian story.
Right. And the Jewish one, you know, I mean, that's, you know, of course, that's Abraham and Isaac, you know, as well.
And all of those things are, to some extent or another, deliberate. And yet the Dardennes are not religious. They have religion in their background, but they're really interested in the moral choices that the characters make, and they don't have religious motivations. Someone asks the protagonist, "Why are you doing this? No one would do this." What you're doing, there's a grace in his actions that defies explanation. And when he's asked, he says, Olivier says, I don't know. I don't know why I'm doing it. And the Dardennes don't know either. That's why they're telling the story.
Yeah. And that's the interesting thing, is that it's so much in our culture that it's part of our bloodstream. And so it's sort of like the story of the Lewis mentions a story of a an American Indian who was asked to help create a grammar of his own language, basically for Christian missionaries who are going to try and put the Bible in their language. And I don't know if the story is true or not, but it says that the Indian guy thought about it. And he said, "My language doesn't have a grammar," and of course it did. Right. It was just that he was so familiar with his own grammar, he didn't realize it was part of the way he spoke. It's kind of like, you know, when you have your hat on. And then you take your hat off, it feels like you've still got your hat on, but when you've got your hat on, you forget that you've got your hat on.
Right. That's
how deeply infused into our outlook Christian and Jewish concepts and values are. So we don't see them a lot of times, and they're right there staring us in the face.
Sure. At the same time, you know, there is a value in exploring the question of religion and in art in different ways. And one right. lens, not the only lens, but one lens to look at in order to gauge certain aspects of our culture and of Hollywood culture in particular is with the literal representation of Christian characters.
Of Christian characters, absolutely.
Right. And yeah. when you recognize that, you know, well over 80% of the population identifies as Christian and something like 22% identifies as Catholic, right. You know, we should be seeing movies representing characters as having some kind of religious orientation a lot more often than they do, and in particular being Christian a lot more often than they are, and it shouldn't just be the bad guys. One really striking example, I think, of the way that cinema has moved in a secularizing direction comes when you look at older movies that have been remade. One of the big movies this summer that people have been talking about from a diversity and representation perspective is the new Ghostbusters. Of course, Ghostbusters 1984 centered around four male characters, and the new Ghostbusters centers around four female characters. And so from a certain perspective, you can regard this as a corrective to this imbalance in how Hollywood portrays men and women. On the mm-hmm. other hand, the original Ghostbusters, not a pious film, but a film that had religious themes shot through it. The characters talk about the Book of Revelation and Judgment Day, and the Archbishop of New York is on hand in the mayor's office to offer his opinion that this is that there's a sign from God, even though he's not going to give the church's official position on it. And right. then there's a scene where Finkman says in the big climax at the end, "Nobody steps on a church in my town." And there are priests at the end giving out blessings. None of these religious themes are in the remake, which very faithfully follows the original in many respects. It's just these religious themes have just fallen off the radar.
Right, right. Yeah, well, and we will continue discussing the place of religion in Hollywood when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and our co-host today is Deacon Stephen Gardonis. We'll be back right after this.
Redbox Media now is a great way for you to go deeper with your favorite show or shows in our programming lineup. With our Friend of the Show opportunity, you get extra exclusive content from your favorite show hosts and lots of extra love from the shows and hosts you love. Become a friend of the show by clicking on the link on our website or app menu. Your $10 monthly premium membership will unlock an exclusive world just for you. Support your favorite show today as a friend of the show. Friend of the Show premium memberships exclusively for you with Redbox Media.
I'm Mark Shea. We're here today with Deacon Stephen Gardonis. If you want to join the conversation, feel free to give us a call at 1-573-4-BREAD, 41573 for Bread 4. And you can also tweet us at Breadbox Media. Well, we've been talking a little bit about Hollywood and religion. We're going to switch gears a little bit now and move on to a new movie that's coming out. Steve, tell us about Pete's Dragon.
So I don't know about you're a little older than I am, so when the original Pete's Dragon came out, you were too old for it, I'm sure.
Yeah, that was just past.
Yeah,
it was just the time when going to Disney movies was cool, and was now into the time when going to Disney movies was like, Mom. And then later on, you get older again, and then you start back to Disney movies because you don't care whether it's cool or not.
Right.
So yeah,
but this was the same. This was the same year that Star Wars came out, and I remember seeing both of these movies in theaters: Star Wars and the original Pete's Dragon. And at the time, you know, Pete's Dragon was my jam. My siblings and I loved it. We saw it in the theaters. We watched it on the small screen any number of times. We knew all the songs. We actually made up sequel stories because the story ends with Elliot the dragon leaving Pete now that he's happily settled with a family. He's kind of like Mary Poppins. The dragon is going to go off and find some other child in need to help. So and we made up stories about this. It was looking back now, I look at this film and I watched it with my kids a year or two ago. And man, they were just brutal. They really just ripped. And I couldn't argue with anything that they said. They were absolutely right. It's not a very good film.
Okay.
Although people, for nostalgic reasons, they do still love it. Well, Disney is currently in this kind of mini arc that started last year with Kenneth Branagh's Cinderella and then continued this spring with Jon Favreau's The Jungle Book. And now Pete's Dragon joins those other two films in this class of well-done live-action remakes of films from the Disney catalog that actually improve on the originals. And Pete's Dragon not only avoids a lot of the problematic aspects of the original film, but it fills it in with richer elements of emotion and themes and so forth. And there's even some pretty intentional, I think. You're talking about religious resonances, right? Mm-hmm. How you can find religious resonances. So we haven't actually changed gears because we're going to talk about that.
Okay.
The movie starts out with Robert Redford and Bryce Dallas Howard. Redford is Howard's father, living in your neck of the woods in the Pacific Northwest. Howard's character is a forest ranger, and she's a kind of very scientifically minded person. She only recognizes, according to her father, what's right in front of her nose. Now, the father tells stories about having encountered the Millhaven dragon. This is kind of this local legend. He says he's seen the dragon. She doesn't believe him. He says to her, just because you don't see something doesn't mean it's not there. And she goes back to him and says, and just because you say something is true doesn't mean that it is. So there's a question of, you know, experience and ontology on the one hand, and then the voice of authority on the other hand, and skepticism and so forth. And, you know, clearly there's a larger theme of belief and interpretation of reality going on here.
Cool. Well, I'm glad to hear that. My wife will be delighted to hear that because she was always fond of the original Pete's Dragon. I'm waiting for them to do, you know, the heavy, serious adult version of Herbie the Love Bug.
Well, you know,
we learn about Herbie's fraught relationship with his father, Henry Ford, or I guess Hitler actually would be Herbie's father, wouldn't it? So, see, that would be that'd be a lot of tension right there.
See, the funny thing is that some of the films Disney was producing in the 1970s, they were already pretty dark, and I mean, you think about the themes in Pete's Dragon. You've got white slavery, you've got alcoholism and drunkenness, you've got unethical medical practices, I mean, Pete, when we first meet him, he's running away from these terrifying, snaggle-toothed, hillbilly, this hillbilly family called the Gogans. And they have paid some kind of money in order to have him as a foster son. And to him, it's a bill of sale that entitles them to own him and to basically use him as a slave. And they're, you know, it's dark and it's yeah. nasty, but it's all spun in this kind of musical lightheartedness and slapstick and so forth. And, yeah. you know, this is the same decade, of course, as The Rescuers, another story about an orphan girl who's been kidnapped by this terrifying creature. And
well, and you got to say that kids literally, I mean, this goes all the way back to Robert Louis Stevenson, too. You know, there's Kidnapped and, what am I thinking of? With the pirates, Treasure Island. You know? Yeah, where you got some, you know, kid in, you know, terrible danger from, you know, slavers or kidnappers or pirates or, you know, sure. desperate characters, you know.
But taking those themes seriously, not packaging it as slapstick and comedy the way that Pete's Dragon does.
Right,
and,
yeah.
You know, the same thing with Helen Reddy's Father's Drunkenness. You know, Mickey Rooney is drunk constantly. And that's why nobody right. believes him when he says he saw a dragon, because right. he's the town drunk.
Right.
And
this is back when being drunk was just funny.
Right. But, yeah. well, you know, I kind of thought it was before. You know, this seems like a throwback to me. I associate that more with the Golden Age. But this is a family film of the 1970s.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly on the trailing edge of that, you know. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I mean, gee whiz, again, you know, this goes back so far in American, you know, humor, you know, the drunken bum who's hilarious, you know, and is a comic foil and all those sorts of things. Yeah, we really don't start getting, you know, like really, you know, this is what drunkenness actually means. You know, this is what it actually is. It's not funny until very recently, you know. So, yeah, so anyway. Continue. Sorry.
Well, you know, one of the things that I appreciate about these films, these new films, that this kind of Disney mini renaissance of reinterpretations of their previous films, is that each of them kind of has its own jam, its own theme, its own feel. You look at, you know, the Disney renaissance of the 1990s, and all of those movies kind of have a very similar vibe. It was really set by The Little Mermaid in 1989, which after, you know, just coming at the tail end of this long period of Disney doldrums, of which the original Pete's Dragon was very much a part, you know, it discovered a fresh energy with a few very simple moves. And one of them was Broadway-style show tunes. You know, these big show-stopping musical numbers. This was not the way that music had been handled in Disney animation in the past. And it changed everything. And then from The Little Mermaid, you got Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin and The Lion King and Pocahontas and so forth. And, you know, as time went on, the formula began to pull. But it was very successful and very strong for a while. Well, here, you've got these three films, and they're all different. You know, right. Kenneth Branagh's Cinderella is just this polished, elegant fairy tale, this princess fairy tale that really does the Cinderella story right. And then Jon Favreau takes the bones of Disney's Jungle Book and grafts in some Kipling that wasn't in the original cartoon, but then also gives it this kind of Raiders of the Lost Ark swashbuckling cliffhanger boys' adventure feel kind of rollicking and action-packed. And yeah. you can understand why it was so successful. Now, Pete's Dragon doesn't have that. And I'm going to be very interested to see if it really connects with the audience in the same way, because it's more soulful and quiet, and it gives the characters a chance to breathe, and it focuses on emotions and wonder. Wonder is a very important thing that's missing in a lot of films today, in particular missing in family films. And I'm one of the reasons I'm really glad to see it.
Oh, excellent. Well, I'm really looking forward to this then. My wife will be tickled pink to hear that it's good. And that'll be fun. What else is going on out there?
I think we're coming up on a break pretty soon.
Yeah, when we come back,
we can talk about the ongoing dissolution of the DC Comics universe, at least from a critical perspective.
Suicide Squad
was it had a great weekend at the box office. It remains to be seen how it's going to hold up, but in terms of how it was received by critics, that's a very different story. So let's talk about the relationship between, you know, how a film is evaluated by audiences and how it's evaluated by critics. Okay. And why that is.
All right. DC seems to have been taken over by ugly, dark Nietzscheans.
So far, Zack Snyder has been the auteur, and I've called his perspective brojectivism. It's kind of Ayn Randian objectivism across the frat
town. No wonder I hate it. We'll be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis. And we will be back right after this.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Hi, diddly ho, neighbor. And welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we're here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis. So, I'm sorry, you were saying before the break.
Suicide Squad.
Yes.
So, and the DC Comics universe in general. Yeah, there's, you might be aware that I'm something of a superhero fan.
Get out.
You might know this about me.
Yes. Do tell.
Yes, I have thousands of comic books in boxes and mostly in plastic bags out in my garage. And from the time that some of my earliest memories of childhood were watching the absolutely terrible 1960s Spider-Man cartoon in reruns on Channel 11.
Steve. There's hope and healing for your condition. So I just want you to know that.
And so, while I was always more of a Marvel Comics guy than a DC guy, I mean, you know, Batman and Superman. I mean, also George Reeves on television. I mostly remember the black and white episodes, although perhaps we were just watching it on a black and white television. The old campy 1960s Batman TV show. These were big things for many of us growing up. I'm sure even you have some attachment to these things.
And I'm a fan of something that I wish that they would remake. It was not really a comic strip thing, but I loved Space Ghost when I was a kid.
Uh-huh.
So, big fan of Space Ghost when I was a kid. So there you go. Anyway.
All right.
Yes, but well, you know, and I was a Superman fan, and I liked the kind of goofy comic booky, original with Christopher Reeve.
Mm-hmm.
Those were fun movies, but man, you know, DC is just one endless dark Nietzschean. You know, the strong do as they will, and the weak suffer what they must. Nihilist. Pit these days. I can't even stand to bother with these things. You know, the best ones have been Christopher Nolan's Dark Knight series.
Yes,
there was something redemptive in those stories.
Sure,
as dark as they get, but man, just where you look for some kind of hope in the DC universe, they give you this sort of Nietzschean Superman, and now Suicide Squad, which is kind of this remake of the Dirty Dozen. You know. in a DC universe. But
well,
anyway, go ahead.
What has struck me about the movies in general and the way that they've been shaped by Zack Snyder, that just before the break I called his bro-jectivist outlook. He does have this kind of Ayn Randian, strong people are important people. And so he has this idea that Superman should be great, but he can't be bothered with the idea that people should be inspired by them, because that would be taking ordinary people way too seriously, giving them attention. So he can't be bothered with making him an aspirational figure, because, you know, it's all about him. And then Batman versus Superman was a very dark film. And now what we have here in Suicide Squad, you know, you've got Batman presumably trying to pull together the Justice League in order to defend the Earth from extreme threats. And now you've got Viola Davis as a long-established character named Amanda Waller, whose idea is to try to get the same job done using a crew of bad guys. And so it's a movie that tries, I think, to combine something of the anarchic appeal of Guardians of the Galaxy with some of the themes from Avengers, and then the nihilistic badassery of Deadpool, which I have to say, you know, I didn't see, but mm-hmm. but that seems to be what it's going for. And mm-hmm. you know, you've got Margot Robbie as Harley Quinn, who's the Joker's squeeze, and Will Smith plays Deadshot, sharpshooting assassin, who I think was the original of which Deadpool was the Marvel ripoff.
Okay.
And, you know, there's some things that I like about the film. It's got, you know, a certain energy and a vibe that's different from other superhero movies. And Margot Robbie is a really good actress, and she commits to the role of Harley Quinn in a big way. Mm-hmm. But the more time you spend with these characters, the worse the movie becomes. And some of this has to do with moral considerations. Mm-hmm. And it's a little bit different with each of the two characters. So you take Deadshot. Deadshot is established as supposedly this stone-cold contract killer. We only see him killing one person. It's a very bad person, apparently. So he's a mafioso who was about to testify against another one. And so we don't feel too bad about that guy. But then the movie immediately humanizes him by establishing that he's got this young daughter and she loves him. And he not only cares about her, but he kind of wants to be a good father to her. And he wants to shield her from the other side of his life and to be there for her in some way. And, right. you know, it strikes me as a movie where they've given Will Smith a kind of Will Smithian character to play, but then he's also a stone cold assassin because the plot says that he is, not because we can imagine this character actually making the choices that would put him in that place.
Okay. Yeah.
Then there's Harley, where you have the opposite problem. Harley is portrayed as a thrill killer, somebody who became the person that she is because she kind of fell under the Joker's spell. And in the animated series, that's one thing, because the Joker in the animated series, there are limits on how bad he can be. It's for kids.
Right.
And so her character is a little more silly. But here, we're really being asked to enjoy the over-the-top personality quirks of a character whose whole persona is based on the fact that she's been really kind of psychically violated and brutalized by the Joker.
Yeah.
And so the film kind of straddles this uncomfortable space between what you might call faux nihilism and the real thing.
Right.
And I don't know which is worse.
Yeah. And sort of enjoying a character with Stockholm syndrome. I mean,
exactly. That's exactly right.
And, you know, I mean, the thing is that, how should you put it? She's going to become an action figure. She will be on a Happy Meal. She's going to become part of the new normal, somebody that you think is cool and to imitate. And she, you know, and she's kind of the, you know, sort of a, you know, the feminine half of Leopold and Loeb, you know. or, you know, Bonnie and Clyde. I mean,
right.
Yeah, just not somebody that you want to hold up as an icon, you know.
Yes, that's as edgy and as envelope pushing as the movie aspires to be, it still fits very comfortably in that highly marketable PG-13 range, and it is something that's going to be marketed to, you know, to little kids.
Oh, and sure, she's going to grace t-shirts, and there's going to be, you know, there's going to be lines of underwear, you know, I mean, all of that, you know, lines of thongs, I mean, frankly, you know, because that's where that character goes. And it's, yeah, and it is, it's all pitched to a 12-year-old, yeah. So anyway,
so this is not to say that there's no hope. Have you seen the trailer for Justice League?
No, I haven't.
I haven't posted that to your Facebook page. We'll have to rectify that.
Well, see, thank you. You know, thank you, sir. May I have another?
The Justice League movie looks as if they've cut the trailer to look as if they really learned their lesson, and you know they're trying to make it feel like Marvel fun. Okay. And then there's a Wonder Woman trailer that also looks as if that could be good. So we will have to, and hopefully they're going to, and they're going to be working on, there's Man of Steel 2 is coming out, and I understand that Snyder is not directly involved. And so
hopeful. Yeah. I mean, I just wish that he would just go away and stop making movies and never be seen again, but that's not going to happen. Because there's big money in that guy. But, just a baleful influence on our culture, and I want it to stop. So when I'm king, all of these things will be taken care of. You know. But, it looks like we only got a couple of minutes left. Anything else that we wanted to discuss before we close out the show for this week?
Well, I might as well mention that I have just posted to Decent Films a whole slew of new 60-second reviews.
All right.
So, yeah.
Oh, goody.
Yes. And I think all of them, are they all actually 60 seconds? Let me see. Love and Friendship, my review of the Whit Stillman Jane Austen movie, I had to go 2 minutes on that. But everything else, Alice in Wonderland, Jason Bourne, Ghostbusters, Warcraft, a movie that I think I actually got more out of reading the Wikipedia article afterward than I did watching the film.
Well,
Ice Age Collision Course. I think absolutely the bottom of the barrel. I actually wish that no Ice Age movies had ever been made at this point.
Really?
Even if it means no Scrat the Squirrel, this is how strongly I feel.
That's heartbreaking. Well, you know, you could just not watch that ever again and just go back to Scrat. Just anyway. Well, I'm Dots. I was your host, Mark Shea, and our producer today was Ian and Jen Longworth, I'm guessing. We'll be back on Monday with Simca Fisher. Until then, have a great weekend. Bye-bye.